silenced by the sound of a staff striking the floor. A hush descended on the chamber as everyone turned to face Nudin.
"We underestimated the power of the perished land," he said shakily. "It waited for us to channel the magic into the malachite, and then it attacked. The table was destroyed, and I myself was almost killed. My good friends here..."
He waved his staff in the direction of the fallen Magi, whose rotting remains and frozen corpses reflected nothing of their former power.
"Were unlucky. As their most senior Famuli, you are the highest-ranking wizards in Gerdlegard."
He stopped to cough up a mouthful of blood and staggered backward, leaning against the fossilized Lot Ionan for support.
"The attack has taken its toll on me, as you can see. It is our duty to repair the table as quickly as we can, for only then will we be able to repel the perished land. The survival of humankind depends on our success. Ordinary armies will be helpless against the pestilence."
The Famuli looked at one another bleakly, shaken to the core by Nudin's sobering words and the sight of their dead mentors.
"They were so powerful, but the perished land subdued them," whispered Jolassin despondently. "How are we supposed to—"
"We should give them a proper burial,"
Runcha said distractedly.
"We can't just leave them here."
She was trembling.
"Gerdlegard is relying on you to be strong,"
Nudin exhorted them.
"If you don't act now, we'll lose our only hope of repelling the perished land. You can mourn the dead when it's over."
He traced a circle on the floor with his staff.
"Gather round, join hands, and repeat the incantation after me."
The Famuli did as instructed, Runcha and Jolassin standing side by side and drawing strength and comfort from each other. Nudin took his place in the circle and laid his staff on the floor. His fat, clammy fingers reached for Jolassin's free hand, and the unfortunate Famulus clasped them with revulsion.
"If you please, estimable Magus, I've brought the artifacts you loaned to Lot Ionan."
He turned in the direction of the bag, and Nudin nodded curtly. Then they began the incantation, calling on the magic to come forth and enter the splinters of the table. The hours wore away. Enchanted Realm of Leos Nudin, Gerdlegard, Summer, 6234th Solar Cycle. It was raining at daybreak, or pouring to be precise. Summer, in all its glory, reigned over Gerdlegard. But for the duration of a few hours the sun had retreated, allowing the sky to cloud over and quench the parched soil. No doubt the vegetation was grateful for the downpour, but the dwarves were unimpressed. Huddled under a tree, they waited grumpily for the rain to stop.
"Now you see why we live in the mountains," scowled Boindil,
who was taking the opportunity to shave his cheeks. Over the past few orbits, he had become increasingly restless. His warrior's heart longed for action so that he could swing his axe and shriek and spit at some orcs. But the chances of that in Leos Nudin were depressingly slim.
"What if he goes into a frenzy?" Tungdil asked Boendel in a whisper. "Should I hide in a tree?"
The dwarf wrung the rainwater out of his plait and grinned from ear to ear.
"You'll be safe, so long as I'm around to direct his fury onto something else. I try to steer him clear of anything that breathes, and it works quite well, for the most part."
They kept their eyes fixed on the nearby thoroughfare, watching the carts and carriages roll past. One young couple seemed more interested in each other than in driving their oxen. The dutiful animals kept up a steady trot. The sight of the lovers reminded Tungdil of a subject that had been bothering him for a while. He wondered whether to ask the twins' advice, although he was beginning to feel embarrassed about his ignorance of dwarven life. For someone who had spent his formative years surrounded by books, he asked incredibly foolish questions.
"So much for being a scholar."
Curiosity got the better of him eventually.
"What do girl dwarves look like?"
he asked, avoiding their gaze. There was silence. The patter of rain on the leaves seemed deafeningly loud. The brothers let him stew for a while. Then Boindil said,
"Pretty. Very pretty," added Boendal, amplifying his brother's terse reply.
Right. There was silence again. Overhead, the shower was easing, the drumming raindrops fading to a steady drip-drip of water trickling from the twigs and branches. He tried again.
Do they have beards?
Silence. Tungdel became acutely aware of the rich variety of noises made by falling rain.
Not beards, exactly, said Boindil. More like wispy down, explained Boendal. It looks lovely.
No one spoke. The sun burned a path through the dark grey cloud, and summer triumphed over Girdlegard. Tungdil decided to broach an even more delicate topic.
When men dwarves and girl dwarves...
He broke off under the secondling's withering stares. Boendal took pity on him.
It's high time our scholar got to know his kin, he said dryly.
He glanced up at the tree.
The downpour's over. Let's go.
He stood up, followed by his brother.
You didn't answer my question.
You didn't ask a question. And anyway, you're the one with all the learning, not me.
Do girl dwarves fight, too?
Some do, but in our clan they mostly stay at home, said Boendal as they moved off along the road. Our womenfolk devote themselves to domestic duties, herding animals in the valleys, stocking our pantries, brewing beer and making clothes. No good ever came of the sexes fighting side by side, Boindil added darkly.
He seemed to be speaking from experience, but there was something in his voice that warned Tungdil not to probe.
Don't make the mistake of belittling their talents, though. They're just as proud as we are. Some of the best masons and smiths in the kingdom are women. When it comes to artisan contests, they use their chisels and hammers so proficiently that other competitors stop and marvel at their work. Anomalies and exceptions, growled Boindil, who was obviously of the opinion that certain tasks were the preserve of male dwarves. For the most part, they belong by the hearth. The kitchen is their calling.
Tungdil had been listening attentively.
It's like that in human kingdoms, too, he told them.
The idea of female dwarves seemed more appealing than ever, and he was eager to become acquainted with their kind. At last they reached Perista. Tungdil gazed in wonderment at the turrets and domes of the palace, but his companions exchanged bored smiles, needing no further evidence that human architecture was inferior to their own. Tungdil had been hoping to find Lot Ionan and unburden himself of Gareen's books and artifacts, but he was sorely disappointed. At the palace, they were told that the council had dispersed some orbits earlier, and that Nudin the Knowledge Lusty was not receiving guests. There was nothing for it but to follow Lot Ionan to Ionandar. They were on their way out of the city when Tungdil spotted a stable in one of the side streets. The horse inside it looked strangely familiar.
Wait here, he instructed, striding toward the chestnut steed.
He felt sure he had shod her not so long ago. He lifted her right foreleg and examined the shoe. The nails were unmistakably his own.
It's them, he hissed.
Friends of yours? Asked Boendal,
whose crow's beak was resting casually on his shoulder. His brother was absent-mindedly stroking his freshly shaven cheeks in search of stray whiskers.
Not exactly.
Noting the bulging saddlebags, Tungdil fetched a bucket, turned it over, climbed on top of it, and fumbled with the buckles. The bag came open, and the dwarf rummaged inside, until his fingers came into contact with a jar. He pulled it out quickly.
Remember the dead dwarf in the caravan?
His instincts had been right. The jar unscrewed to reveal a head. The bounty hunters had shaved the poor fellow's hair and beard so that the grisly trophy would fit inside the container, which was filled with honey to stop the air from getting in, thus preventing decay. Streaks of blood trailed through the golden fluid, staining it red.
We've found the villains who killed him.
There was a clatter of chainmail, and the brothers were beside him like a shot. Neither spoke as they stared in horror at what had been done to their kinsmen for the sake of a reward.
By the blade of Vrakas, I'll cut them to pieces!
Roared Ironheart. Fury ignited within him, flushing him red and prompting his axes to fly into his hands.
Just wait until I...
The door swung open, and one of the headhunters walked into the stable from the house. Tungdil knew him immediately, and the recognition was mutual as the man stopped abruptly and swore. After considering the three dwarves for a moment, he decided that the odds were against him and fled.
"Cowardly as a runt,"
scoffed Ironheart.
"Come back here and fight!"
He chased him into the house, and there were sounds of a brief but energetic skirmish that climaxed in the man's dying screams.
"Don't!"
Tungdil's shouted warning came too late.
"He would have been more use to us alive," he finished mildly.
He could hardly blame Boindil. The fiery warrior was at the mercy of his temper and came to his senses only when his opponent lay bleeding on the floor.
"We'll wait for the others to return," Boindil said phlegmatically. "Didn't you say there were five of them in total?"
Tungdil nodded, and they took up position in the stable. It was early evening when the men returned. Judging by their sullen faces, their honeypots were empty and their efforts had been in vain. Waiting for them behind the door was the vengeful Ironheart, an axe in each hand and seconded by his brother, who had concealed himself among the straw. The twins were so accustomed to fighting together that any intervention on Tungdil's part was likely to be a hindrance, so he lurked in the background and kept out of the way. Once the men had entered the stable and dismounted, Boendal and Boindil nodded to each other and launched their assault.
"Leave one of the villains alive!"
shouted Tungdil, joining the tail end of the charge. Alerted by the commotion, one of the headhunters turned and reached for his sword. The blade was only halfway out of its scabbard when Boindil's axe thudded into his left hip. The force of the blow sent him tumbling against the wall. Before he could recover, the dwarf's second axe hit his right calf, hewing skin and sinew and shattering his knee. The man collapsed in screams of pain. Satisfied with the crippling effect of his blows, Ironheart moved on. Cackling terribly, he hurled himself on the next of his foes. His brother was left to deal with the remaining men. Shoulders squared, he charged toward the first of the two, leveling his crow's beak as he ran. His opponent had enough time to snatch his shield from the horse and thrust it in front of his body, but he underestimated the weapon's force. The spike at the tip of the crow's beak pierced the metal, ripping through the shield and stabbing the man in the arm. Wood and metal had done nothing to repel the weapon. Now flesh and bones yielded too. The soldier screamed. Boendal jerked the spike out of the shield and rammed the pole against the man's unprotected knee. The force was enough to smash the joint and buckle the leg. The second headhunter was down.
"I'll show you what happens to spineless dwarf killers!"
Boiling with rage, Ironheart slashed at his opponent with fast, powerful strokes. Tungdil could see that the men were doing their best to parry the frenzied blows of their attackers, but their expressions revealed the hopelessness of their plight. Where there was fear, defeat often followed, and so it was this time. Boindil whirled his axes above his head. Unable to guess the direction of the attack, the panicked headhunter turned to his horse. His legs outpaced the dwarven warrior, but his speed was no match for Boendal's weapon. The crow's beak soared through the air, hitting the man's back just as he was swinging himself into the saddle. The impact cracked his ribs, stopping him momentarily. It gave Ironheart enough time to catch up.
"You're too tall for my liking, Longan,"
he snorted, slashing at the man's legs and severing his tendons. His victim toppled, and Ironheart dealt him a double blow to the collarbone that finished him off. The dwarf went in search of the fourth headhunter, who was cowering behind the mound of straw.
"Now it's your turn!"
Ironheart's chainmail was spattered with his opponent's blood, and his eyes glinted crazily.
"Who do you pray to? Palandiel? Samusin?"
The man cast down his sword and raised his hands.
"We'll surrender,"
he said hastily. Ironheart bared his teeth.
"Too bad,"
he growled, thrusting his axes into his enemy's unprotected midriff. The man collapsed amid agonized groans. He died quickly but painfully, as Tungdil could tell from his muted whimpers. Tungdil surveyed the stable. The chief headhunter, whom Ironheart had put out of action at the beginning of the fight, was lying in a pool of blood. He seemed to be fading rapidly. The dwarves hurried over.
"Who pays for your handiwork?" demanded Tungdil. "Tell us, and you'll be spared."
"We'll leave you to drown in your blood if you don't,"
Ironheart said threateningly.
"Bind my wounds,"
the man implored them, pressing his hand to the flowing gash in his hip.
In the name of Palantio, have mercy on me!
The blood was flowing so fast that Tungdil doubted anything could save him. The magic of a magus, perhaps, but certainly not a bandage. Ireheart turned on him furiously.
Tell us, or I'll let my axes do the talking!
Before he could make good on the threat, the headhunter expired. The dwarves left his side and hurried to the remaining survivor, whose shield and arm had been pierced by Boendal's crow's beak. The man was gritting his teeth. Pride prevented him from screaming aloud, but the pain from his shattered knee was almost too much to bear.
Be merciful,
he stammered.
I don't know much, but I'll tell you. We heard about the reward in Gauragar. They were offering gold in return for groundlings' heads.
He pointed to Tungdil.
It was just after we met him. Who's they?
Bellowed Ireheart. He laid the bloodied blade of one of his axes against the man's throat.
The guild! The master of the guild!
He choked fearfully.
He sent us here. We harvest the heads, and every 30th orbit he sends a man to fetch the jars. We get our share of the reward, 30 coins apiece for each head.
The guild? What guild? Demanded Tungdil.
The guild of the bounty hunters!
The man groaned as the pain threatened to overwhelm him.
Let me go now! I've told you everything I know!
Tungdil believed him, but he knew the twins would never let him live. His murderous deeds would have to be punished.
You're not going anywhere.
Ireheart's axes settled the matter before Tungdil could object. The headhunter had breathed his last.
Come on,
Boendal said evenly. We need to get out of here before the watchmen arrive. Hefting their bags, they hurried out of the city in the direction of Ionandar. At first they were worried that someone would find the bodies and chase after them, but no one did. Tungdil felt a pang of conscience.
It wasn't right to kill them,
he said, as they were sloshing their way through puddles and mud.
We should have handed them over to the watchmen along with the jar.
Boindil's eyes narrowed.
Are you telling me I should have let the villains live?
He shook the raindrops from his beard.
They would have been tried and hung anyway. What difference does it make?
They deserve to die, I know, but if we'd...
Tungdil couldn't think of how to describe his nagging guilt in a way that Ireheart would understand. Boendal leapt to his brother's defense.
No, scholar, there are no two ways about it. They murdered for money and died because of it. What does it matter that we killed them? Boendal's right. The Longans would have hung them, but we saved them the trouble. And we avenged the dead dwarf.
He tossed his plat over his shoulder to signal that his mind was made up.
It was the right thing to do.
Tungdil could find no argument that might persuade him otherwise. He was still too much the scholar to understand his companion's dwarven way of thought.
We need to press on,
Boindil reminded them in a more conciliatory tone.
The High King is waiting.
The battle in the stable had cooled his raging temper, and he was calmer again. Enchanted Realm of Leos Nudin, Girdlegard, Summer, 6,234th Solar Cycle.
I can't keep this up for much longer,
Rancha muttered despairingly.
You mustn't stop now, whispered Jolasin. If any of us leaves the circle, the ritual will be broken. I owe it to my magus. We all owe it to Girdlegard to keep going.
Just then, he heard a change in Nudine's voice. The croaky rasp became a high-pitched purring that didn't seem to belong to him at all. After a while, it lowered to a bass tone so deep that it vibrated through the apprentices' bodies. None of them, not even the highest-ranking Famuli, had heard anything like it. And yet it worked. Pulsing with light, the dark green fragments of malachite rose into the air and came to rest 3 paces above the floor. Even the splinters in the decaying flesh of Myra the Life Preserver left her body, exiting with a gentle pop as they bored through her skin.
What did I tell you?
Said Jolasin, giving Rancha's hand an encouraging squeeze.
We're nearly there now.
Nudine the Knowledge Lusty began a new incantation, and the Famuli resumed their chanting, only to break off shortly afterward, unable to follow the words. Babbling and gibbering incoherently, the Magus had lost his thread. With the rest of the circle reduced to silence, the ritual was doomed. Meanwhile, the fragments of malachite clustered together in a flat disc 10 paces in diameter. The glowing circle began to spin.
"Is this part of the ritual? I've never done this before," hissed Jollison.
Rancher made no reply. The disc spun faster and faster, the splinters drawing closer as the speed increased. Soon the individual fragments joined together in a circular sheet of flawless crystal.
"My Magus knows what he's doing,"
Rancher whispered proudly, breathing a sigh of relief. A hush descended on the room as the ring of apprentices watched in awed silence while the glowing malachite morphed under Nudine's command. At last, the impressive spectacle drew gasps of admiration and relief from some of the Famuli.
"We did it!"
Jollison was about to throw his arms around Rancher, but was stopped by the Magus, who tightened his grip on his hand. Nudine spoke, uttering a single, unintelligible word. A splinter flew out of the disc and pierced Jollison in the chest. No one noticed.
"What?"
Groaning, the young man tried to free his hand and touch the spot where the jagged splinter had entered his flesh and buried itself deep inside his chest. He could feel the blood seeping from the wound and trickling down his abdomen, but Nudine was gripping him firmly in his cold, clammy clasp.
"Estimable Magus,"
Jollison said, his voice strained with pain.
I'm hurt. I've been hit by a shard."
Nudine turned his pale, bloated face toward him. His pupils were dilated, almost obscuring his irises. Then the black dots turned the color of tarnished silver. His misty eyes glinted.
"I know, my boy. I needed your magic. There was no other way."
He squeezed his hand reassuringly.
"It won't hurt for long."
The Magus closed his eyes. Another tiny splinter of malachite flew across the room and hit Rancher. From then on, the splinters followed in quick succession, striking the apprentices so rapidly that half of their number had been wounded before the others noticed. They called to the Magus for help.
"Stay where you are, or everything will be ruined,"
he commanded, eyes still closed. The remaining Famuli were unpersuaded by his words. Rather than stay and be killed by the lethal crystal, they decided to run for cover. But by then it was too late. As they tried to pull away, they realized with horror that their hands were stuck together, tying them to one another until they too were struck by shards. The malachite disc sent dark bolts in the direction of each Famulus, green light caressing their bodies eagerly in search of the splinters and slipping inside the wounds. Nudine looked up, an insane glimmer in his eyes. Throwing open his cloak, he uttered another incomprehensible command. At once, a finger-length shard of malachite flew toward him, on a bolt of green lightning, and planted itself in his chest. The beam intensified, pulsing and rippling with light, while the tendrils of energy binding the Famuli to the crystal faded and dimmed. Soon they were gone altogether.
"Victory!"
The Magus's shriek of triumph was too shrill and powerful to be human. He laughed exultantly.
"The time for dissembling is over. Nudon the Doublefold is once more."
The Famuli slid to the floor. Jollison, Rancher, and the others were incapable of speech. The malachite had wrested the magic from their bodies and plundered their strength. The more fragile among them were the first to succumb. Their hearts stopped, their breathing failed. A small band of Famuli, Jollison and Rancher included, summoned the energy to drag themselves across the floor in a desperate effort to reach the doors. The Magus plunged his fingers into his chest and was feeling around for the splinter. He withdrew the bloodied fragment, gazed at it dreamily, then replaced it in the wound. He took a step toward the malachite disc.
"You served your purpose. Now be gone!"
No sooner had his onyx-tipped staff made contact with the hovering crystal than it fell to the ground, littering the floor with myriad splinters.
"Don't just stand there," he told himself sternly. "Let the next phase begin."
Gathering the leather bag brought by Jollison, he hurried to the door, skewering 3 crawling Famuli as he passed. A tide mark of blood stained the white maple of his staff. On reaching the doorway, he stopped and looked back, scanning the foul-smelling room. The stench of decay would soon be overwhelming, but it was all the same to him. His work was almost done, and he was leaving the conference chamber for the final time. It was then that he noticed Rancha and Jolison. With a brutal swipe of his staff, he crushed the Famulus's skull. His own apprentice had nearly reached the door, but he nudged her back into the chamber with his boot. Rancha rolled onto her back, tears streaming over her face, and uttered a healing charm. Her magic failed her. The Magus stooped to stroke her long brown hair. He knew the Famula well, and she was talented, one of his most gifted pupils, in fact. She would probably have made it into his discipleship in Leos Nudin, but he knew that she couldn't be relied on to cooperate with his plans.
"The malachite splinter inside you has left you weak and helpless," he told her. "The magic is gone. You'll die like the others, Rancha."
The young woman stared up at him accusingly. Her dark eyes were full of contempt for the Magus, whom she had trusted implicitly and who had forfeited her respect. Nodon looked away, surprised at how much he was affected by his dying apprentice.
"I didn't want to kill them," he said defensively. "There was no other way of obtaining their magic. What was I supposed to do? Andokai, Lothionan, Myra, Sabora, and Tugur refused to help me. And you and the other Famuli would have turned against me too. I knew it was going to be difficult, but I did it because I had to. This is my destiny. Gerdlegard must be protected from evil."
"There is no greater evil than the perished land," she said,
breathing in rapid gasps.
"The gods will punish you for betraying our circle."
Nodon thought for a moment.
"Perhaps you're right. But the vengeance of the gods is a small price to pay for saving mankind."
He got to his feet and stepped out of the chamber.
"And mankind can be saved only by the perished land and the chosen few."
"You're mistaken,"
whispered Rancha. Her gaze faltered. A sigh ran through her body, and her head slumped back, falling to the side.
"No,"
Nodon contradicted her sadly.
"I'm right, but no one understands. My dear friend told me this would happen."
Closing the doors with a wave of his hand, he turned away quickly and hurried through the palace to the vaults. There was a dull thud as the doors of the chamber slammed behind him, sealing Gerdlegard's most powerful wizards in their tomb. Clumping down the stairs, Nodon reached the room where the energy was at its strongest. From Leos Nudin, the force field extended outward in five directions, supplying the other realms. He was about to change all that. The Magi and their highest-ranking Famuli had been taken care of, but there was still the matter of the lowlier apprentices. Nodon was incapable of stopping the flow of energy, but he intended to reclaim the young wizard's meager powers by other means.
"First, there's something I need to attend to."
He loosened the green drawstrings, opened the bag, and turned it upside down. An hourglass hit the floor, shattering on impact, followed closely by two amulets, which tinkled against the marble. A roll of parchment landed on top. Nodon stared at the motley collection.
"These aren't my things,"
he thought furiously, scattering the pool of sand in all directions with his staff.
"Confound Lothionan!"
He reminded himself of the need for calm. Besides, he could always ask the orcs to retrieve the items from Ionanda. Focusing his mind, he used his powers to search for the force field, and on finding a connection, uttered the charm provided by the perished land, thereby releasing the magic he had plundered. Chapter 8. Enchanted Realm of Ionandar, Gerdlegard, Late Summer, 6234th Solar Cycle. To speed their progress, the three dwarves bought ponies and rode without stopping, dismounting only to spare their aching backsides. Even then they kept moving, continuing on foot. Over the course of the journey, the twins taught Tungdil a number of ballads that were known to all dwarves, irrespective of folk or clan. Little else remained of the common heritage linking all the children of the smith. The melodies were simple and easy to remember, embellishments and ornaments playing no part in dwarven songs. To Tungdil's ear, they sounded rather melancholy, a tendency he attributed to the gloominess of the underground halls. The mood was noticeably lighter in songs such as Glinting Diamond, Cold and Bright, or There is a Golden Shimmer in a Faraway Range, where the lyrics told of great treasures and gold, and he enjoyed the drinking song A Thousand Thirsty Gullets, A Thousand Flagons of Beer, taught to him by Boindil, who had procured a keg of beer. Tungdil awoke the next morning and cursed his pounding head. According to Boendal, it was all the fault of the Longan's ale, which was vastly inferior to the dwarves' own beer. Farther along the way, they encountered Sami, a peddler with stubbly cheeks and peasant's clothing, who had strange stories to tell.
"Some people say that the cleverest Famuli in the other five realms have left for Leos Nudin," he informed Tungdil, who was examining the array of trinkets on offer while the twins waited patiently. He wanted to buy something for Frala before he forgot.
"Any tidings from Greenglade?"
"The elf maiden is dead. The northern pestilence laid waste to the forest, and King Bruron is worried that wayfarers might get themselves killed. He wants to set fire to it."
Sami made a show of unpacking his herbal soaps.
"Perhaps you groundlings could do with some of these."
"Just because we're dwarves doesn't mean we stink," growled Ireheart. "I'll put you in a lather, you lanky-legged rascal."
"My mistake," Sami said hurriedly. "I thought he wanted something for a lady friend."
"Actually, Boindil, the peddler's probably got a point,"
Tungdil said slyly, throwing him a bar of plain soap. He also bought a jasmine-scented soap, a patterned comb, and a doll each for Ikana and Sunya. Boindil sniffed the soap, scratched at it, and put a shaving in his mouth.
"Ugh, it is disgusting. I'm not washing with that."
He tossed it disdainfully into his bag.
"So the Perished Land is still advancing," probed Boendal.
"It looks that way. Most of Alendur has fallen already, and the elves are under constant attack. Some have fled to the plains of Tabaín, or so I've heard."
The peddler packed the gifts in coarsely woven cloth.
"Everyone says the Alfar are getting the better of them. They've taken the other elven kingdoms, and if you ask me, Alendur will be next. It's only a matter of time before the Alfar conquer the last of their land."
He handed the parcel to Tungdil.
"A silver coin, please, Master Groundling."
"Dwarf,"
Tungdil corrected him.
"Pardon me?"
"We're dwarves, not groundlings."
"Of course,"
Sami said, again hurriedly.
"Absolutely."
He cast a distrustful glance at Boindil, who was admiring his shaven cheeks in a mirror. Tungdil was still digesting the news about Alendur.
"What do you think the Assembly will have to say about it all?"
he asked the twins.
"Serves the elvish tricksters right,"
said Boindil with a shrug.
"Most of them are dead already, and the others will follow if they set foot in our range. The pointy ears aren't welcome near Ogre's death. I don't care whether they call themselves elves or alpha. They won't be moving in with us."
Tungdil scratched his beard.
"What of the orcs?"
he asked Sami.
"Oh, they're in three places at once, if you believe the rumours."
The peddler looked at them dolefully.
"It's not safe on the roads anymore. Teon's creatures are on the rampage, and King Bruron can't do anything to stop them. Innocent folks like us have to fear for our lives and our wares."
Boindil scanned the horizon longingly and licked his lips. Tungdil heard him making oink noises under his breath. A while later, they took their leave of the peddler and rode on. To keep their purse stocked with coins, Tungdil jobbed as a smith, helped by the brothers, who also ornamented window frames and doorways with wonderful carvings. That way, they kept themselves in ham and cheese, while making good progress toward Lot Ionan's vaults.
"You got bits of cheese in your beard," Tungdil said to Boindil at the end of a meal.
"What of it?"
"Well, it's not nice to look at,"
he answered, trying to be diplomatic. Boindil ran a hand over his chin and dislodged the largest morsels.
"There's still..."
"Look here," Boindil told him brusquely. "The rest can stay where it is. It keeps the whiskers sleek and smooth."
As if to emphasize the point, a breadcrumb fell from his lips and landed in his beard. Tungdil had an image of the hares coming to life and feeding on the scraps. It would explain why nits weren't a problem. The whiskers would gobble them up before they had a chance to settle.
Surely the girl dwarves must have something to say about your...
There you go again!
Boindil clapped Tungdil on the back and grinned lewdly. There was cheese between his teeth.
Always on about girl dwarves.
Patience, scholar, Boindil advised him.
Play your cards right, and you'll find out firsthand. You're not bad-looking. I'm sure we'll find you a suitable lass.
And then what do we do?
You make eyes at her, of course.
Boindil gave him a playful dig in the ribs.
You sing her a song, you give her a hand-forged ring. Then you kiss her feet, cover her in a nice thick coating of her favourite cheese, swing her four times in a circle, and the gates to her godly guard will open.
That's... It doesn't say that in the books, said Tungdil, bewildered.
He looked at Boindil, whose eyes sparkled roguishly. Boindil couldn't contain himself any longer and let out a side-splitting guffaw.
Idiots, huffed Tungdil. It's not funny, you know. I can't help it if I've never met a female dwarf.
We didn't mean to offend you, apologized Boindil,
wiping away tears of merriment.
But maybe you should try it. It seems to work for Boindil.
That was it. His brother dissolved into laughter too, the gentle hills of Ionandar echoing with their mirth.
Just be yourself, said Boindil,
endeavouring to be serious.
I can't speak for everyone, but it's no good pretending to be something you're not. He used to say he was a poet,
his brother chuckled.
His lady friends never believed it, but with you it might work.
What sort of presents do they like best?
Ah, very cunning, exclaimed Boindil. Sorry, scholar, but you can't bribe your way into a lady's heart. There's no secret formula. Either she likes you, and she'll tell you as much, or she doesn't.
And she'll tell you about that, too,
Boindil added merrily.
I wouldn't wish that on anyone, said his brother. But if she likes you, well, anything is possible. But enough about womenfolk.
Their journey continued, and after several orbits, Tungdil began to recognize his surroundings, which meant they were getting closer to Lot Ionan's vaults. He was looking forward to seeing the Famuli and being reunited with Frala and her daughters.
They'll never believe that I'm an heir to the throne.
To prove that he hadn't forgotten her, he knotted Frala's scarf around his belt. After a while, they came to a river. A ferry was moored on the opposite bank near the ferrymaster's house, and smoke was rising from the chimney. Tungdil reached up to ring the bell that was suspended from a tree beside the berth. That way the ferrymaster would know to come and fetch them. Boindil grabbed his hand.
What are you doing?
I'm calling the ferry, unless you prefer to swim, said Tungdil. It's either that or get the boat.
Boindil eyed the swirling water. The river was lapping against the banks.
We'll go a different way, he decided. It's too deep here. We could fall in and drown.
You could fall off your pony and break your neck, Tungdil countered sharply. Come on, Boindil, it's too far to the next crossing, two orbits at least.
When he saw the twins' stony faces, he knew it was useless to protest.
Oh, it's this way, he sighed, pointing upriver. But I don't see what's wrong with the boat.
It was all the encouragement that Boindil needed to launch into the story of why dwarves and water didn't get along.
Long ago, Elria put a curse on us. Elria was born of water, and water was her element. From the beginning, she took a dislike to the dwarves. Vrakas's fire-loving, furnace-tending children couldn't have been more different from her water-dwelling creatures. To protect her children, she put a curse on the dwarves. And now any dwarf who ventures into water outside his kingdom is doomed to drown.
Lakes, rivers, ponds or streams, according to the twins, even puddles could pose a mortal danger, and they avoided water at all costs.
It's an excellent excuse for not washing, Tungdil told them.
They rowed until nightfall and arrived the following orbit at the ford. When the time came to cross, the brothers waded nervously through the fast-flowing water, the river swirling ferociously about their thighs as if it intended to carry them off. It was evening when they finally neared the entrance to the tunnel leading into Lotionen's vaults. Boendal and Boindil grew uneasy at the thought of wizardry and spells.
"I didn't like coming here the first time," grumbled Boindil. "Lotionen is a nice enough fellow, I'll grant you, but he's a magus. At least we dwarves have the good sense to know that Hocus Pocus never did anyone any good. We stay away from it. If Rakkus had wanted us to dabble in magic, he would have given us wands."
He stared at Tungdil suspiciously.
"You understand that, don't you? I hope he hasn't given you any daft ideas."
"I can't weave magic," Tungdil said soothingly. "I've never even tried."
He stopped for a second and looked at the brothers imploringly.
"Promise me you'll treat him respectfully. Without his charitable intervention, there wouldn't be another claimant to the throne. In fact, it's only because of his salutary..."
"Listen to him," Boendal said sarcastically, mimicking his voice. "Do you hear the scholar speaking?
Quite the gentleman, isn't he?
He must be refining himself for high faluffing conversations with the more educated race."
"High falutin," Tungdil corrected him with a smile. "All right, point taken. Either way, be nice to him or say nothing at all. You can wait at the gates if you'd rather. I'll be fine on my own."
It was already dark by the time they got there. Even from a distance, Tungdil could see that the door to the tunnel was ajar. It was usually bolted and protected with a magic incantation, but one of the Famuli must have forgotten to do his job. Tungdil grinned mischievously, his tanned face creasing around his eyes. Whoever was guilty of such negligence would soon regret it. He intended to give the vault's inhabitants the shock of their lives.
"Tut, tut!"
Boindil said disapprovingly when they reached the open door.
"The confounded thing better not close behind us. What if it's a trap to catch innocent travellers?"
"Why would the magus want to trap travellers?"
his brother inquired.
"Well, to try out new gobbledygook on them, of course. You don't think he'd experiment on his own apprentices, do you? He needs to be sure that his wizardry works."
He looked to Lotionen's protégé for confirmation, but Tungdil chose not to get involved. Boindil unhooked an axe from his belt and mumbled threateningly into his beard.
"If any of those wand-wielders so much as looks at me oddly, I'll show them what for."
Boindil burst out laughing.
"Don't worry, I'll be sure to punish them if they turn you into a mouse or a bar of soap."
He gave the butt of his crow's beak an affectionate pat, but his brother was frowning grimly. Tungdil noted their squared shoulders. It was clear from their posture that they were ready to fight. He decided to head off any possible misunderstandings by leading the way.
"Keep the noise down," he told them. "I want to take them by surprise."
Boindil looked skeptical.
"It seems to me that's just asking for trouble. What if they put a spell on us by accident? They might not recognize you in time."
Tungdil waved dismissively and stepped into the vaults. At once he was surrounded by the familiar aroma of paper, papyrus, parchment and 100 dusty books, mixed in with the smell of stone and a hearty whiff of supper.
"Boiled potatoes and meat," he declared.
He looked over his shoulder at the twins, who were more interested in studying the tunnel and speculating in low tones about who had built the vaults and why.
"You can tell it's the work of Longins,"
Boindil was saying.
"Do you see this? I noticed it last time as well. To think they didn't bother to work with the rock. They've cut through the strata with no concern for the veins."
He pointed at something.
"If they'd troubled themselves to look properly, they wouldn't have got themselves into such a mess. Even I could do better, and I'm a warrior."
"A precarious design."
Boendal was gazing at the ceiling that was propped up every few paces by pillars and struts.
"There's too much sand in the soil. An engineer or a miner would never have taken such a risk."
He prodded the ceiling gently with his crow's beak, loosing a shower of mud and stone.
"I'm no expert, but they should have dug the whole thing out. See how the warmth has dried the sand strata and made them all crumbly. Your magus needs a lesson or two in how to dig tunnels. It's a good thing we're here."
"Shush," Tungdil reminded them firmly. "You'll spoil the surprise."
"No sentries, no alarm system, nothing."
Boindil rolled his eyes.
No wonder Vrakis told us to take care of the Longins. The whole place would be easier to conquer than a dead dragon's den. Dwarves are more careful,
he continued in a whisper, still loud enough for Tungdil to hear. Tungdil tiptoed on. His eyes had adjusted to the dim light, but the vaults were too quiet for his liking. There was no chattering of voices or banging of doors. If it hadn't been for the tantalizing smell of supper, he would have suspected the Magus of moving his school elsewhere.
Maybe they've abandoned the vaults and left the cook behind, mused Boindil out loud. Hardly surprising, given the state of the place.
The comment earned him a reproving look from Boendal.
Surely they'd take the cook with them, he couldn't help asking. Not necessarily, Boindil grinned. He might be so bad at his job that they've made him stay and practice until the ceiling caves in. Either that, or he's stewing in his soup.
Tungdil was too intent on reaching the Magus' study to listen to their chatter. He knocked on the door. No one answered, so he walked straight in.
I'll wait out here with Boindil,
Boindal called after him.
We don't want to spoil the reunion.
On entering the room, Tungdil could scarcely believe his eyes. One half of the study was in a state of chaos, with books, sheets of paper, and scribblings strewn over the floor. The other half was impeccably neat. Tungdil had never seen such orderliness in Lot Ionan's study. The books were stacked on the shelves in alphabetical order, the paper had been left in tidy piles, and the quill and inkwell were in their proper places.
He must have dreamed up a new charm that makes the mess tidy itself, he thought, impressed.
He could see the logic in trying it out on one half of the study, but there was still no sign of the Magus.
I hope the spell didn't tidy him away.
He wandered round the chamber, looking for anything that might explain the silence in the vaults. Boindil sighed loudly.
Waiting is a hungry business, he declared. I'm off to find the kitchens. If we ask nicely, they might spare us a bite.
We should take Tungdil with us, his brother said anxiously. The Longins won't know who we are, don't forget.
All the more reason for introducing ourselves.
Boindil was too hungry to worry about being cautious.
You can wait if you like, but there's a hole in my belly stretching down to my knees.
He strode off. Boindil was reluctant to let him go anywhere unsupervised. They were guests at the school, and guests were expected to behave with a modicum of decorum, which didn't come naturally to his twin.
Tungdil, we're off to the kitchens, he shouted. I'll keep an eye on Boindil, don't worry.
He hurried to catch up with his brother, who was disappearing around the corner. The twins had no trouble finding their bearings in the vaults. Vrakis had given his children an infallible sense of direction when it came to orienting themselves underground. They knew instinctively whether a passageway would slope upward, downward, or curve gradually to one side, and they had no need of the stars to plot their course. In this instance, they were guided by the tantalizing smell. All the rooms they passed were empty. There wasn't a soul in sight.
Maybe it's dinner time,
Boindal suggested hopefully, trying to ignore his growing unease. They made for the passageway, where the smell of meat was strongest. Their tunics and armor clanked softly while their heavy boots clumped rhythmically on the floor. At last they reached a door that led into the kitchen, judging by the splashes and smears. Boindal tried to surge ahead to make a more orderly entrance, but his brother beat him to it. He gave the door an almighty shove. Four great hearths burned in the high-ceilinged room, but otherwise the kitchens were as deserted as everywhere else. Curiously, there was evidence of recent activity. The stoves were roaring, and supper simmered and hissed in covered pans. Large round cooking pots hung above two of the hearths, chunks of meat rising to the surface and sinking into the bubbling brown broth. By now, Boindal had a definite feeling that something was wrong. Abandoned rooms and brimming cauldrons. It simply didn't add up.
What's going on?
He scanned the kitchen carefully.
This is more like it,
Boindil said cheerfully. He let go of his axe, tore off a piece of bread, and headed purposefully for the nearest stove. Balancing on a stool, he lifted the lid of a pan and peered inside. Juicy slabs of simmering meat and gravy. His mouth began to water.
I'd be rude not to taste it.
He dunked a sizable hunk of bread into the sauce and prepared to swallow the morsel in one bite.
Stop!
His brother's warning brought him to a sudden halt.
What? No!
He snapped, his stomach growling in protest at being neglected for so long.
Can't you see I'm eating?
Bowendal had positioned himself next to the door, crow's beak at the ready. Judging by his stance, he was anticipating trouble.
I don't mean to spoil your appetite, but take a look over there.
Bowendal followed his gaze. The butcher's block, used ordinarily for chopping and filleting meat, was piled high with bones that had no place in a kitchen. Four skulls in particular held their attention. They were human in form. It took a while for Bowendil to link the bones to the broth, but then he hurled away the dripping bread in disgust and jumped to the ground, drawing his axes.
When I get hold of that Magus, there won't be a spell in the world that can save him,
he muttered darkly.
Humans and wizards aren't usually cannibals,
Bowendal told him.
If you ask me, there's been a change of guard. The Magus didn't forget to lock the door. Someone attacked.
He peered into the corridor.
It's time we found our scholar.
Walking back to back, they retraced their steps through the eerily empty passageways, Bowendal leading and Bowendal following and watching his back. Tungdil sat down on the footstool next to Lotionan's armchair and waited impatiently for the Magus to return. For want of anything better to do, he dusted off his garments. All he could think about was what the Magus would say when he made his report. He had already decided to start with the most important business, Garin's books. There was no reason to believe that Lotionan would divulge their mysterious contents, but Tungdil hoped he would. Just then, he heard someone approaching from the corridor. He knew at once that it couldn't be Bowendal or Bowendil. The soft footsteps belonged to a light, unarmored man. Tungdil was too bored to pass up an opportunity to amuse himself, and leaving the knapsack and bag of artifacts beside Lotionan's chair, he leapt to his feet and hid behind the door, intending to jump out and scare the unsuspecting Famulus. Chuckling silently in anticipation, he peered around the door. The young man who came into the room had short black hair and was dressed in the malachite robes of Nudine's school. He made straight for Lotionan's papers and set about sorting through his documents with shocking disrespect.
What in the name of Vrakus is he doing?
Tungdil watched from his hiding place as the Famulus sifted through a stack of notes, thereby solving the mystery of the unusually tidy room. Next, he made himself comfortable at the Magus's desk and set to work on the higgledy-piggledy documents and books, sorting them into piles and jotting the details on a list. Tungdil looked on in amazement.
Who allowed one of Nudine's pupils to forage through Lotionan's things? What's he doing here, anyway?
If Lotionan wanted someone to tidy his study for him, he had plenty of likely candidates in his own school. But Tungdil knew that the Magus was very particular about his work. The documents that the young man was handling were strictly private, and no one was permitted to look at them, least of all an apprentice from another enchanted realm. Dragging footsteps sounded in the corridor, and a second figure appeared at the door. The Famulus looked up crossly, not bothering to hide his annoyance.
What is it?
Tungdil pressed his face to the crack in the door and peered at the newcomer. All he could see was a broad back and a coarsely woven shirt.
I've finished in the kitchens, said a deep, sluggish voice.
The dwarf placed it immediately. It was Iden, the Magus's groom.
Good. Then find yourself a quiet corner and stay out of my way, came the Famulus's sharp reply.
Iden stayed where he was, filling the doorway like a fleshy statue.
I'm hungry,
he said dully.
Why don't you gnaw on some bones in the kitchens?
The Famulus said impatiently.
But remember not to touch the meat. It's for our sentries. Now leave me in peace.
I want meat,
the man insisted.
Go!
The Famulus picked up a letter opener and hurled it at him. Whether he intended to wound the groom or whether it was a poorly judged throw, he succeeded in striking Iden in the chest. The man groaned and staggered from the room. At last, the dwarf could see his face, which was ashen and horribly mangled. A club had crushed the right side of his head, and his visage looked barely human. At the sight of his torso, Tungdil took a sharp intake of breath. The pale fabric of Iden's shirt was caked with blood from two deep gashes to his collarbone and chest. The afflicted flesh was decaying, the skin around it yellow. Tungdil was instantly reminded of Greenglade and its gory revenants.
No, he thought. The perished land can't have breached the magic girdle.
Lot Ionan had gone to Perista to renew the barrier and preempt an attack. And in any event, the perished land's dominion ended 450 miles north of Ionandar's vaults.
Then why is Aiden still alive?
A gust swept through the room, and a blue shimmer appeared in the air, gradually assuming the contours of a man. It was Nudine, the Knowledge Lusty. The Famulus rose and bowed before the apparition.
"I've been searching the school as you requested, estimable Magus," he reported, straightening up to face the bloated wizard. "There's no sign of the items you mentioned. Goodness knows why the old man needed so many laboratories and libraries."
He decided to get his excuses in quickly.
"The vaults go on and on. It's a lot for me to manage on my own."
"Which is why I shall be joining you in person."
Tungdil hardly dared to breathe, lest he give himself away. Vrakas seemed intent on making him eavesdrop on all kinds of awkward conversations. He had seen Nudine once before, but he remembered him as being slimmer, healthier, and decidedly less cruel. The Nudine before him was like a caricature, an uncharitable likeness drawn by a detractor.
"Lot Ionan told me that the items were in a cupboard," the Magus continued, swiveling to survey the room.
There was something oddly high-pitched about his gravelly voice.
"Have you searched the place properly?"
"Not yet," the Famulus admitted. "I thought the books were more important, so I decided to hunt for them first."
Nudine shuffled toward the large cabinet from which Tungdil had retrieved the artifacts at the start of his errand.
"There's no proof that the books even made it to Ionandar. According to the Alpha, a war band stole the books from Greenglade after the orcs had razed the place. Dwarven bandits, apparently."
"But didn't you tell them to... I mean, how?"
"The Alpha are good allies."
Nadine's doppelganger stopped in front of the cabinet and propped his staff against the wall. It took some effort for his swollen, spectral fingers to depress the handle, but he got there in the end.
"Their only weakness is their love of art. For this particular Alf, it proved fatal."
Bending down, he reached into the cabinet and came up with a leather bag, identical to the one that Tungdil had been carrying.
"It looks as though our search has been rewarded."
He loosened the drawstrings and tipped out the contents. 5 rolls of parchment tumbled to the floor. His grunts of displeasure seemed to indicate that he had been hoping to find something else. Tungdil peered out a little farther. His packs were hidden by Lot Ionan's chair, but he had an uncomfortable feeling that Nudine would be delighted to discover them. It was then that it dawned on him. The ties on his bag were blue, but the Magus had said something about green drawstrings.
"I took the wrong bag. I marched for miles across Girdlegard, and Goreen's artifacts were here all the time."
From the point of view of his errand, it wouldn't have made any difference if he had got to Greenglade and found Goreen alive. He would still have been carrying the wrong set of things. But something told him that his mistake had worked out well. Tungdil couldn't quite make sense of it all. He had no idea why Nudine and his apprentice were behaving as if the school belonged to them, much less why Aiden was acting so oddly, when really he should have been dead. But the fact that the Magus had allied himself with the Alpha was clearly bad news. Nudine, the Knowledge Lusty, seemed to have changed sides. He had to find out what had happened to Lot Ionan and his Famuli without alerting the intruders to his presence.
"One more thing,"
said the apprentice, riffling through the papers on the desk. He pulled out 2 pieces of parchment that Tungdil recognized as the letters he had sent.
"Lot Ionan received a couple of letters from someone called Tungdil, who was looking for Goreen on his behalf."
He passed the correspondence to his master, who scanned the lines with bloodshot eyes.
"Tungdil," he said musingly.
"Of course. The old man kept a dwarf of that name. It's perfectly possible that he's the one who took the artifacts and the books."
He tossed the letters onto the desk.
"Travelling dwarves are a rarity in Girdlegard, so it shouldn't be hard to find him. I'll ask the Alpha to deal with it, and they'll deliver him, dead or alive."
He nodded to the Famulus.
"It's a pity you didn't mention it earlier, but at least we're getting somewhere. You shall have your reward when I join you. Until then, keep searching. You never know what might turn up.
The apparition flickered and faded, then vanished altogether. After his many ordeals, Tangdil was beginning to think that nothing could shock him. But he hadn't reckoned with listening in silence while someone plotted against his life. His metal was being thoroughly tested. The Famula smiled smugly and sat down at the desk. He had pleased his master and secured a measure of the approval that he so craved. He buried himself once more in the documents. He was just dunking his quill into the inkwell, ready to add another entry to the list, when he happened to glance toward the armchair. The straps of Tungdil's knapsack were protruding from one side.
What?
He got up slowly and crossed the room to examine the object that had materialized without his knowledge. He stooped to pick up the leather bag. Tungdil drew his axe. Speed and surprise were of the essence. He had to strike before the Famulus saw him and cursed him. He tensed his muscles. Even as he prepared to charge, a commotion sounded in the corridor, stopping them both in their tracks. For once, the twins were making a genuine effort to be quiet. They didn't know who had invaded the vaults, but it seemed safest to hack them to pieces without giving them any warning. Whoever had butchered the Longans would surely jump at the chance to eat a dwarf. But a crow's beak in the belly or an axe through the gullet was bound to cure their greed. They heard lumbering footsteps. Boindil signalled for his brother to freeze, and they waited for the creature to stagger around the corner. There was a whiff of rotten flesh. Then a man stumbled toward them, groaning. His injuries were so horrific that it was a wonder he was alive. No ordinary mortal would have survived such wounds. But on seeing the dwarves, he yelped in excitement and lunged toward them with surprising speed, spurred on by the prospect of fresh meat. His eagerness was no match for the warrior's experience. Boendar saw the blow coming, skipped sideways, and jabbed him in the knee. The revenant swayed. In falling, he hurled himself on Ironheart, who greeted him with a war cry and a pair of flashing blades. The secondling avoided the toppling body and reached out to cleave the man's left arm. Teeth grinding in anger, Iden dragged himself across the floor, baring his teeth at the twins.
"Would you believe it? He's coming back for more,"
observed Boindil in astonishment.
"I know revenants are supposed to hate the living, but this is ridiculous."
He decapitated the man, thereby putting an end to his undead life. The brothers set off at a run to find Tungdil. It seemed likely that other bloodthirsty revenants would be roaming the vaults, in which case the heir to the throne could be in danger. On reaching the door to the study, they saw a young man in malachite robes standing by an armchair, holding Tungdil's leather bag. Their noisy skirmish in the corridor must have prepared him for their arrival.
"Burn, you scoundrels!"
His right arm flew up, fingers pointing at the dwarves, and he opened his mouth as if to speak. The door slammed shut. The brothers blinked in surprise.
"Surely he didn't need a spell for that," said Boindil. "Why didn't he just close it before we got here? I told you wizards are weird." "Magical mumbo-jumbo. Leave it to me."
Launching himself at the door, Boindil stormed inside, shrieking. The young man had fallen backward and was lying motionless inside a cabinet. The doors were open and the shelves had slipped their brackets, scattering their contents on top of him. His forehead had been gouged in the process, and he was bleeding from the wound. Tungdil straightened up and rubbed his head.
"I should have put on my helmet before I headbutted him in the belly," he declared. "Didn't I tell you those lessons would pay off?"
Boindil patted him on the back.
"You've got the makings of a first-class dwarf." "It's about time someone explained what's going on," his brother said impatiently. "There's human broth on the stove and revenants roaming through the corridors. What kind of character is your Magus anyway? None of this would be happening if Lot Ionum were here."
Tungdil gave a brief account of the eavesdropped conversation between Nudeen and his Famulus, then listened while the twins described the scene that had greeted them in the kitchen. In combination, the stories proved beyond a doubt that Nudeen had seized the vaults and emptied them of their inhabitants.
"Surely he can't have killed them all."
Tungdil sat down, overcome with horror and dismay.
"What of the apprentices, the servants? Frala, Sunya and Ikana.
He refused to believe that the lunatic Magus could have murdered a wizard as powerful as Lotionen.
He's alive, I just know it.
He clung to the hope that Lotionen had escaped with his senior Famuli and was preparing to do battle with Nudin.
I have to find him.
The Dwarven Assembly needs to hear about this, ruled Boendal. Let's get out of here.
No,
Tungdil said firmly.
Not until I know where Lotionen has got to.
He looked at the unconscious apprentice.
I bet he could tell us.
He knelt down and boxed his ears. It had the desired effect. The Famulus's eyelids fluttered open. Boendal stood guard at the door while his brother placed the spiked tip of his crow's beak in the gap between the young man's eyes.
If you so much as think of cursing me, I'll ram my weapon through your brains.
He obviously had every intention of carrying out his threat.
I crack skulls as if they were eggshells.
Tungdil bent down toward him.
Tell us where Lotionen is,
he demanded, torn between wanting an answer and fearing the truth.
Are you the dwarves from Greenglade?
The Famulus seemed perplexed.
But aren't you supposed to be...
Answer the question!
Tungdil told him roughly. Boendal leaned on his crow's beak, applying just enough pressure to pierce the Famulus's skin. Blood welled up around the metal spike as it bore into his brow.
Tell us where he is, or we'll kill you.
Don't hurt me,
the apprentice whimpered.
I'll tell you anything you want. He's dead. Nodon killed him.
Nodon? Commander of the Perished Land?
It was Imperista. He killed them all.
The terrible truth was out. With the other Magi dead, there was no one in Girdlegard who could rival the traitor's power.
Nodon cursed the force fields, so no one else can use them.
An icy dread took hold of Tungdil when he realized what the Famulus was saying.
So Nudin is Nodon? Nudin commands the Perished Land.
The evidence had been staring him in the face, but either he hadn't realized, or he hadn't wanted to. He felt like shrieking at the Famulus, or cutting him to pieces on the spot, but he forced himself to ask another question.
What does Nodon want with the books and the artifacts?
I don't know. Nodon told me to look for them, but he didn't say why. I swear I don't—
Tungdil whacked him with the pole of his axe, returning him to his feint. Once he was safely tied up and locked in the cupboard, they debated what to do with him. It was obvious that they couldn't release him. A wizard with hostile intentions posed a serious threat,